Welcome, everybody. We have Richie Blinkback with us this afternoon, and he is going to, today, he told us, be positive. His topic is leveraging nature to protect communities in the Mississippi River Delta. And as always, want to let you know that he is being recorded, so are you if you are participating in conversation. Hope you will.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone for being here. The last session was a bit depressing, and many things seem to be going wrong in coastal Louisiana. But today I'm going to talk about how to leverage nature to protect communities. And I want y'all to jump in as much as possible. And if I'm going too fast or you don't know a certain term, be sure to stop me so I can clarify. So, I'd be happy to explain. So looking at the future, we need to look into the past. First Nations people built mounds one basket of mud at a time, like this one. They knew they couldn't fight nature, so they built these mounds to live with water much better. When they pooled their efforts, they were able to live in places that were exceedingly productive. So the First Nations people had a civilization here before European settlers ever came to the area. There are mounds like the red dot up at Poverty Point where arrowheads were found. Those arrowheads were made from stone that came all the way from Yellowstone. And so you can see across the southern end of the state how these mounds were created so that the folks could live better with water. But you can see there's many of them that are concentrated along the Mississippi River corridor, and that was to get out of this annual flooding cycle of the Mississippi River. So this tuft of trees is known locally as the lemon trees, and it's another mound built by the First Nations people. This site is near my home. It was a seasonal camp, and the people understood that to enjoy the bounties of nature, they couldn't live there full time. So this was more of a camp. About 300 to 500 years of occupation is what it took to build this mound. And you can see, this is kind of a silhouetted photo, but the flat lands around, that's marsh, and it's almost like a prairie, and the trees are growing on the mound itself. So I'll just kind of recap some of the causes of land loss from yesterday. There's the subsidence, which is the ground sinking. There's sea level rise, which we're yet to really see the effects from. There's the energy navigation canals, just natural erosion of the land, hurricanes, and saltwater intrusion. And of course, the river levees preventing sediment from working its way out into the wetlands. And so today we're going to talk about all the different tools available to leverage nature to protect these communities. And specifically, we're going to talk about the multiple lines of defense strategy and how Barrier Islands, diversions, marsh creation, all work together to protect these communities. So starting out at the Gulf itself, we have Barrier Islands, and these serve as a sort of a speed bump. Marsh also serves to slow down the flow of water, and as well as these natural ridges. Trees in front of levees knock down storm surge. And we'll talk about some of the other man-made lines of defense later on. And so those trees in front of levees actually lower wave heights 15%, according to the Corps of Engineers. So first is the Barrier Islands. And of course, as I mentioned, these serve as speed bumps. And when there's not a hurricane, they also serve to slow down the tidal prism. And what's going on in Louisiana, the tidal prism is the amount of water that flows in and out with each tide. And so there's been, if you could just imagine, everything on the backside of this island was once marsh. The nautical charts from the 1920s and like the 1880s, it was almost solid. And so now all that land has been replaced with water, and so there's an incredible amount of water flushing through there. So the worse the problem gets, the quicker the problem gets worse. This is also really great habitat too. There's all sorts of migratory birds that nest on those shores, and there's back marshes there. So another way to leverage nature is to use marsh creation. And marsh creation is it's a way to mechanically build land. And so I'll show you just what can be done and how that's done. So this is the Lake Hermitage Marsh Creation Project before it was constructed. And what's going on here is there were oil and gas canals here, and these dead-end canals were each individual wells. And you can see how the land here has subsided, but over here where there wasn't any oil and gas development, the land still remains. And so now this is pretty much a highway for water to work its way in for a hurricane.
So are the wells that were in that eight part, are they still active?
No, they've been plugged and abandoned a long time ago.
Richie, when you're talking about canals, I don't understand why there were canals for the oil project.
So this ground is really soupy, and to bring in a huge drilling operation, it's much easier just to float it in. And the mud there is almost like pudding, and they were able to just dig these canals really easily. It was much easier than trying to build some kind of road, and so that's why they dug the canals. So the second slide here, you can see what the contractor did. The contractor built these cells, and then they started pumping in sediment from the bottom of the Mississippi River. And Kathy, you and I visited the site, and we were actually standing where the B is. Mm-hmm. And this site was still under construction. We were riding around here in the boat. I think we had lunch near these islands.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And so this is the project after it was completed. And the contractor's bid actually came in so low, additional land was able to be created. You can see up above the Lake Hermitage markings, there's a new shoreline, and if you remember where the cell ends, you can see above the cell, outside of the cell area, land was pumped in, and you can really see here.
Oh yeah.
The differences.
So Richie,
mm-hmm.
once you're getting to this, but once there's land there, it's just like muck, sort of. How long does it take for that to, is there any natural revegetation that happens? Or on the other hand, is it solely left to people like you to plant cypress trees and plugs of grasses?
So this picture right here is before the project was ever planted. And you can see the cell and right underneath the word marsh was just finished up just a few months before the cell in the bottom part of the photo, and the vegetation just takes off naturally. That being said, this project only has a 30-year life, but there are plans to divert sediment later laden fresh water in that will sustain the site, and I do have some slides to that effect later on. And so so this project is built with a cutter head dredge. And the cutter head dredge, it mines sediment off the bottom of the Mississippi River. In some cases, this sediment, it needs to be moved aside anyway to allow for ships to come in and out of the river. A local man is actually developing a fixed sediment pump, and he plans on, he's using an electric motor, and what he's doing is, these are on like a fixed platform on sandbars in the bends of the river, and he uses electricity in the middle of the night when it's really cheap, much like Holden runs their hot water heaters in the middle of the night when the demand is low. So those can even be run off of like sustainable energy. You just think about ways to connect them with a windmill. So it's pretty exciting development. Okay, so this is the Grand Liard Marsh Creation Project, and this is another type of land bridge that was created. And about 600 acres were built here. But this sediment, instead of being mined from the bottom of the river, is actually mined from the Gulf of Mexico. And you can see that the vegetation isn't really taking off as quickly as the other one. The sediment from the bottom of the Mississippi River is really, really great stuff. The stuff out of the Gulf of Mexico has been sitting in salt water for millions of years, and is it takes a few years of rain to flush out that salt. But there is some vegetation that's starting to establish itself. And this project has a 6-foot ridge around it. and the ridge is gapped in a few key locations. And you can actually see it's kind of a low spot here, a drainage, and the vegetation is starting to establish itself along this drainage. It just floats in and is able to take root. So it's taking a bit longer than the other way, but it's still a great project. So yeah, the marsh creation projects are a great start, but they start sinking before they're even completed. Adding that sediment-laden water out of the Mississippi River is the only way to make them sustainable. So these are, yeah, but how does a sediment diversion work? And I'll show you that in the next slide. So this is a sediment diversion is the simplest way of creating land. Of course, the river has been confined to its channel by man-made levees. And these outlying wetland areas have sunk because they haven't had that annual cycle of flooding that brings in this fresh sediment year after year. This is just an artist's rendition, but this next slide kind of illustrates that in a real-world, smaller-scale project. So this is an unnamed coastal restoration project created by a private individual. And the small canal that we call a crevasse in Louisiana was dug by an individual. He impacted a wetland off-site. He was building a residential development, and he needed to mitigate a few acres of wetland damage. And so he petitioned the Corps of Engineers to allow him to dig this because he would make 100 times more land than he impacted. And they allowed him to do that. And he spent only $40,000 digging that cut, and they were able to do it in just a few days. So this picture was taken in February of 2013. October of 2013. And this next photograph was taken.
Excuse me, Richie, just to orient, is this the Mississippi at the bottom?
Yeah, this is in fact the Mississippi River. And so the river is quite deep. It's 120 feet deep or so here. And sediment is just rolling down it at incredible rates. Something like 256 million tons in the last two or three years have gone down the river at Belle Chasse, which is just that river from here. There's a turbidity gauge.
Is that a higher than usual?
No, that's about normal.
Normal, okay.
And so this is this next picture is from about a year and a half later.
Oh.
You can see just how much of a difference that time makes. And there's it's a little hard to see, but there's actually some islands in that are further back that are growing in size due to this crevasse.
Is that land actually usable?
It's usable for habitat and protection. Okay. I mean, it wouldn't be good to build something on.
Okay, because you said he was looking at the development, and that's...
Oh, yeah, he did an off-site development. He was like a real estate developer, okay. And he owns these vast tracts of land he had to mitigate, and he, instead of doing it in some faraway place, he was able to do it on his own property.
I see.
So if you dug down in that new area, when would you reach water level?
Almost right away. That new land is actually intertidal, so when the tide comes up, it covers it. But since it's so close to the river, fresh water is almost always going over the top of it. And that's how those freshwater plants are able to sustain themselves.
Richie. Is the left side of the river, or the picture south? So that's the Gulf we're looking at? The Gulf side?
So in this photograph, it's the location is so far south along the Mississippi River Delta, the Gulf of Mexico is almost on three sides of it.
Oh, okay.
So at this altitude, if I took a picture in the opposite direction, you would see a little bit of land in the Gulf of Mexico behind me too.
Okay. Okay.
But this picture is actually facing kind of the northeast.
Okay.
So. This is a picture of the Atchafalaya Basin, and the Atchafalaya is a huge distributary of the river. And about 100 river miles or so above Baton Rouge, there's this large control structure that allows about 30% of the Mississippi River to flow into the Atchafalaya. And what's happened in the Atchafalaya is it's transformed from these open bodies of water to a filled-in basin. And this canal here is called the Wax Lake Outlet. And what was happening, Morgan City, it's an oil and gas port that's located right here, it was being flooded periodically by the Atchafalaya, and to create an easier outlet for that river water coming down, this outlet was dug. And so this picture is from the early 80s, and you can see in 2012, the entire basin is filled in, and two large deltas have formed. And so if you scale up a diversion, that's the type of land building potential that it has. And so, and this is without any sort of other human intervention. They haven't leveraged any methods to help that sediment fall out at all. In my next slides, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. So, what do you do when you have a lot of water like this that's flowing through these areas? This is the Mississippi River, and Louisiana isn't like Washington. We don't have waterfalls. But sometimes there could be as much as like 5 or 6 feet of difference between the river and the bayous around it. But when that water is moving so quickly, the sediment that's in that water, it can't fall out to the bottom and create land. And so structures like these terraces were created to slow down that water and to build that land. This project was $1.6 million, and a floating traco, we call them marsh buggies, was able to create this project in about a summer's time. And what they did, they just borrowed material from the site. You can see these lighter spots are a little bit deeper areas where they pulled the material from to create these terraces. And this project was getting some criticism. It took a little while for land to show up here, but when it did, it really showed up in earnest. And so this picture is from 2014. And you can see, even outside of the project footprint, there's new lands that are showing up. There's almost a new pass forming up here in the top part of the photograph. So, I mean, if more projects like this were leveraged, there could be way more, you know, there could be some land gains seen in other places too. The body of water behind the terracing project is called Bay Denise. And unlike yesterday's slides where, you know, the land's just going away, Bay Denise, when I was a kid, I used to go shrimping there with my dad. It was like a saltwater lake. And some natural crevasses just kind of broke through the river levee, and it started causing it to fill in. And so now it's really shallow, and it could really benefit from a project like this. So this next slide, this is a little bit closer up. Mm-hmm. And so vegetation is just naturally floated in here, and there's quite a bit of biodiversity. These are phragmites, or a common giant reed. This darker area, this is bulrush, and then the lighter stuff is spartina, or like a oyster grass. And so these are these next slides. These are the aerials of the area, and I really want you to pay a close attention to this area, and then also around here. So you can see a new, the classic Birdfoot Delta shape is showing up, and there's new passes that are forming. And so land is showing up in this area here, which isn't even in the project footprint. And I really like this project, but this is like an engineer thought of this project. A fish didn't think of this project. You know, so if we were guiding nature in a way that mimics nature, if we made this terracing project, if we, for instance, extended this distributary and made it meander and had strategic distributaries along it, we could build land in places that are more advantageous than others. And we could really increase that marsh space that I was talking about yesterday. The marsh space is, for instance, if we were to build an island and it was just square like this podium, it would only have X amount of marsh face. But if we built a sponge, you know, that's much more productive for the ecosystem. So what do you, we've seen a little bit about, you know, hydrologic restoration, reintroducing the river, slowing the river down to capture it, and also pumping sediment to build marsh creation projects. And West Bay is a good example of what happens when you do all three, all those methods together. So West Bay is almost at the very end of the Mississippi River, and politically it was much easier to do a project like this, a sediment diversion down there, than further up in the basin where oyster fishermen are using those areas. And there's other user groups too that are used to salinity being a certain way. 80 years ago when the levees were built and distributaries were cut off, allowed for four or five generations of folks to get used to using these basins a certain way. And down here it's always fresh, so it was much easier politically. So in 2003, an opening was created in the Mississippi River's channel to allow sediment to enter West Bay. But in the previous 80 years, West Bay transformed from an area of open marsh that looked, you know, much like this, with distributaries running through it, to an open water area. For a few years, West Bay didn't really see any land gains despite all that fresh water and sediment rolling in there. And in fact, actually the opposite was happening. The bay was getting deeper. And it really worried folks. So a local rancher who raises cattle in the Delta, Mr. Earl Armstrong, he urged the Corps of Engineers and just about anybody else that would listen to build islands out in the middle of West Bay to slow that flow down and allow sediment to fall out. Of course, leave it to the Corps of Engineers to come up with an acronym for a sandbar. They called them SREDs, or Sediment Retention Enhancement Devices. So once in place, those SREDs, the sandbars, they allow the water to slow down, and then they start, these islands started to form, and sandbars actually caused quite a bit of shoaling in the area. The area is really treacherous now. It's shallow water all over the place, and it's so hard you could drive a cement truck on top of it. It's really good material.
That's Mississippi sediment?
Yeah.
River sediment?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So this is an aerial from 2003, and you can see, not too much was happening here. But the diversion was cut, and so once these islands were created down here, you can see the sediment started showing up, and then also up at the top as well. There's a new pass forming around that island, and it's already started to fill in, and so the delta is just naturally doing its thing there now. And so these are some of the islands that were built, and this round island in the middle, that's new, and it's just naturally occurring after those sandbars were installed on their own. Man, I really ran through this. So this slide takes us full circle back to living with water instead of fighting it. Rebuilding wetlands to knock down storm surge and recreate habitat, it just can't happen as quickly as we need it to. So sometimes it's easier just to raise homes and floodproof businesses. And homes like this are common in South Louisiana. In tomorrow's session, we're gonna explore a plan to live better in the face of rising seas. It's probably gonna be the most heart-wrenching one of all. It's hopeful in the sense that if everybody's included, we can get a culture out of the way before it's too late. So if there's any questions or anything, I know I ran through this kind of quickly. Wish I would use my tongue a little better. But yeah, we could revisit any slide at all. Anything anybody would like to see. Yeah, Kathy?
So could you talk a little bit about the politics and the economics about these diversions?
Yeah,
in other words, who wants to do them, who doesn't,
sure.
Where's the money come from? I know some of the diversions are either canceled or even maybe, do I remember that one was even filled in after it was opened up? Some of those kinds of things?
Yeah, sure. So there's
I'm gonna turn the lights on.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
So we can see you.
If you know where they're at.
How's that?
Yeah, sure, okay. So there's probably no less than two different user groups in these basins. What I mean by basin, everything outside of the Mississippi River, or what we call the fast lands. And the fast lands are the areas that are protected by levees. 80 or more years ago, when these levees were built, they cut off just countless distributaries. And so areas that 80 years ago...
Could you just define distributary?
Oh, a distributary, it's the opposite of a tributary. Like, you know, for instance, Railroad Creek is a tributary. It feeds a larger river. Well, a distributary is just unloading that river out into the Gulf of Mexico or any other body of water. So you know, for 80 years, probably four generations or so, these folks have gotten used to catching species, you know, of fish and shrimp and other commercially sought after species like alligator in areas where they've never before been. For instance, behind my home is a saltwater wetland. And 3 or 4 miles north, 80 years ago, they were growing rice. You know, so just in that little bit of time, it's regressed and changed. But people are used to operating like that now. They're used to running a few minutes and catching what they need. And they're not going out 10 or 15 miles or so like their grandparents used to catch those same species. So folks don't really want to change the way they operate. And taking the estuary and making it much more fresh the way it used to be is going to be highly disruptive. Just in the area I live in, there's 30,000 acres of oyster leases. And when a diversion comes online, if the people don't have any sort of say in the planning process, those 30,000 acres of oyster leases are going to be wiped out. And so, I mean, if you can imagine some valley around here that's growing crops, 30,000 acres of crops being covered up by, you know, a reservoir or something like that, it would be catastrophic to the local economy. The culture would go away anyway. You know, I mean, here. So this has the potential to solve a lot of our problems, but at the same time, the reason why the people are living there, the fishing industry, is going to suffer. And it almost goes back to, you know, the levying of the river, it was for navigation and flood control. And those were done in the interest of national security. You know, having, you know, access to the heartland of America via deep draft ships was good for trade. It was really good for the economy. And now the poorest people there are going to have to shoulder the burden of fixing this problem. And they didn't get really, you know, I mean, they live behind the levees, but they didn't receive a lot of the economic benefits that some other folks did. So it's really contentious, and people feel helpless. You know, like this is being done to them and not with them or you know, something like that. And the other part of your question, some of the diversions have been canceled. So in the area where I live, there were four diversions that were planned. And the two lower diversions have been scrubbed. The state of Louisiana, looking at the new sea level rise data, has decided that they're not worth building. So they're focusing their efforts further up in the basin. There is a fault line near where I live. And what's happening, we're so close to the Gulf of Mexico, and the Mississippi River Delta is so thick, there's about 400 foot of sediment on top of bedrock. And so what's happening is it's sliding vertically down into the Gulf of Mexico, but also horizontally down into the Gulf of Mexico. And this fault line runs like right through my yard, and it's, you know, thereabouts. And so above that fault line, there's about 10 or 12 millimeters a year of subsidence, which sounds like a lot. Below that line, there's like 35 millimeters per year. And so that, coupled with the projected sea level rise, is where the state came up with that decision. Another part of your question, there was a diversion that was being talked about filled in, like a, getting that correct. So there was a distributary of the river that kind of popped up on its own. There was a small salinity control structure that was built for the oyster fishermen so they could adjust salinities to optimize their crop. And over the years, that structure fell into disrepair. And during a high river one year, the river actually eroded the road around it. And so now it's a full-blown river in its own right. There's about 10,000 cubic feet per second going through there. And I imagine that's probably equal to something the size of this room every second. And it has rapids, and it's changing the estuary there. But it happened in such a way that it's almost natural. Now, there probably will be some sort of court case to decide who's responsible, if anybody, for that. Some folks say it's a maintenance issue, and other folks say it's just a natural phenomenon. But this was on the east bank of the river, within a half mile of the end of the levee system. So the very first chance the river had to break free, it did. And it's that pass is, it's been named a navigable waterway, so it's going to be pretty hard to close down. But it's buried a bunch of oyster reefs, and I could show you some photos where there's sandbars popping up in the middle of a bay on their own, and there's no management over there. If we were doing terraces or shreds over there, I mean, we could really be building some land. But I think the state doesn't really want to touch it. They, there's a budgetary crisis as well as a land loss crisis in Louisiana. And if it's building land, then they want to let it. But, the Corps of Engineers, who really has the ultimate authority of the MRMT, the Mississippi River and Tributary System, they're the ones with that power to close it. And in talks with them, they've mentioned that it's not a threat to the river channel, and it's less than 1% of the flow, so they're not concerned right now.
So the main goals that seem to drive it is the ability to get produce up from through the Mississippi down to the end point for shipping?
There's a few different, reasons for, not wanting to change the status quo. Keeping 50 feet of draft open for navigation is one of the big ones. If we could have, if we were operating in some sort of void where, international shipping didn't exist, and we just had sandbars at the bottom of the river, the river would overtop those sandbars every year, and that sediment would create a huge delta. The delta was growing up until the river was altered to allow for that shipping. But it's not just produce, it's steel coming in from other countries, it's manufactured products leaving here, there's cruise ships that use the river, there's container ships that are just huge that go up and down the river too. Not to mention chemicals, refined product, those sorts of things. There's something like 300 million tons of cargo moved per day by ship on the Mississippi River, in and out. It's a really important corridor. The ports of New Orleans, South Louisiana, Baton Rouge, and Plaquemines combined are the biggest port complex in the world. I flew a small airplane from Baton Rouge following the river all the way down to its mouth, and I counted about 270 ships anchored or at a dock, just kind of queued up to load or unload. And they're from all around the world. But there's the users of the basin too that don't want things to change. But I think we're at a point right now where we're experiencing a collapse, and folks are having to move inland, and no less than the entire culture is at risk. Mm-hmm. And so things need to change.
I'm still struggling with the concept. And I'm a total neophyte when it comes to this whole topic. But if you're talking about water rising, mm-hmm. and the sediment is just a sponge, and billions and billions of dollars to create some sediment, how long can the work that's being done here actually sustain an economy of people, a culture, as you're describing it, or is it really that the rising water makes all of this somewhat futile?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard folks compare this to building a sandcastle on the beach. You know, it's just going to continuously be eroded away, have to be rebuilt. But what we need to do is, you know, create this robust wetland buffer around the city of New Orleans and move inland, move critical assets inland as needed. And that's going to be unfolding over time. And while everybody agrees it's going to happen, folks agree about the timeline and the severity.
So this is buying time, is that kind of?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
And with the disappearance of those sediment, that makes that part of the country very susceptible to hurricanes, correct?
Damage. Oh, yes.
There's nothing to stop everything just rolling in.
Absolutely, yes, for sure.
So I would think that the people that are doing shipping and doing all of that, somehow in their mind say they also need to have some sort of a buffer or another hurricane, which will happen. I mean, there's hurricanes in the Gulf all the time. Mm-hmm. There's really no protection for those cities along there after all these wetlands have been destroyed.
So most of the infrastructure for the Port of New Orleans is along the high ground. It's along the river itself. And the way the place was built, you know, the river comes up, it overtops its banks, and the heaviest sediments are deposited near the banks. And so there's these almost natural levees. And that's where all the ship docks are built. Mm-hmm. And so the Port of New Orleans was able to open just a few weeks after Katrina, whereas the rest of the city was still underwater, but they had no place for their workers to live.
Right.
You know, their workers lived in, and this is, you know, something that David hit on in his presentation yesterday. You know, these are the poorest folks, and, you know, in New Orleans, when it comes to income, the better off you are, the higher ground you likely live on.
Right.
And so the poorest folks are pushed out into these reclaimed swamps and had, you know, water to the rooftops, whereas, you know, the more wealthy folks maybe lost their mulch, you know?
Right. Like,
yeah. No flooding in the garden area.
What's that?
No flooding in the garden area.
Not much, yeah, not at all. Like I said, it's just the mulch floating off, that was it. So, the who bears the burden of these things isn't really, you know, fair. You know, I feel like we're not at the point where we should give up, you know, and some folks compare this land loss crisis almost to like a cancer, and I guess depending on how far along you are, you know, are you going to do everything you absolutely can to fight it, or are you just going to, like, you know, give up, you know? And we're not at the point where we should give up just yet, you know? And Louisiana is never going to look like the 1930s map again, and I've accepted that when I was a child, but I feel like there's a lot of improvements that can be done, and a lot of, like, really low-hanging fruit, just really mm-hmm. easy stuff, you know, like building those terraces and reintroducing sediment-laden water in key areas that are going to serve to protect the city. Because, you know, while $14 million was spent rebuilding the levees after Katrina and making them a true system and not just a system in name, there's still not going to be enough. There still needs to be that robust wetland buffer. If Katrina happened, you know, a storm of that magnitude and on that path happened in the 1930s, the city wouldn't have been flooded because there were miles and miles of these tiny little bayous that water would have had to flow through. So, you know, this is a man-made ecological and socioeconomic crisis, you know, and we've engineered our way into it, and we must engineer our way out of it.
And that's the part that I think, when I was visiting with folks after having been down there, it isn't just the ecology, you know, which some people can push up, but when you start talking about the socioeconomic and that generally affects, you know, so it's New Orleans' problem. Well, no, not when you understand the socioeconomic implications of that area not being able to function. I don't think people quite understand how important that whole area and port system is to the rest of the country.
Absolutely, it is very, very important.
I'm more familiar with floodplains. In our area, you aren't allowed to build any longer on floodplains. And are they doing anything to try and control where people are going to be allowed to live?
No, and that's to an extent. You know, you can't build on a wetland without having to mitigate for those damages. But, you know, no politician is going to touch that subject. Mm-hmm. It's politically unpopular.
It may be, but it's also life-saving.
It makes sense. The town near where I live, right now there's an oil import-export terminal that's proposed and was under construction but was stopped. And, the folks that live across from it are like, man, now we're building this in a floodplain. And the local government that represents me is trying to change the zoning so they can build this thing there. And I'm talking with some of these elected officials, and I'm like, you forget that easy? This place can't handle high tide. Mm-hmm. And you're building an oil port right here? And they're like, yeah, we need to develop this. We're going to build a railroad, and we're going to do this and that. And I'm like, you crazy?
Have they tried to get insurance on all of that? They're not going to get it.
And that's really what the driving factor is going to be. You know, right now, there's a proposed $20 billion liquid natural gas facility that is going to be built down there. The place where they want to build it can't drain. You know, and this is right now in its current state. If they want to build that, then they need to build it on like 30-foot piers, like an oil platform that just happens to be on land where the water can come and go underneath. I don't understand how somebody can amass $20 billion to invest and not look at the long term, just like what's been happening in this location, what's projected to happen in this location. It's just astonishing. So you were asking earlier about the, Catherine?
No, I was just going to say, I think maybe the slide before this is the economic one, or a couple before. Okay. The economic, yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's tough.
Yeah, so here's some stats about the importance of the Mississippi River Delta in some of these numbers. And, you know, like this buoy in the bottom picture that this ship is tied up to, 15% of the nation's crude oil comes through that buoy. And it's the only super tanker port in the country. It's 50% of the nation's refining capacity is in Louisiana. Think about your gas tank. Half of what's in your gas tank in your car was, you know, could have been refined in Louisiana. So, I mean, this really, it's a matter of national security to handle these types of issues. You know, it's not just about some people that talk funny that live down in the bayou, you know? I mean, it really is a matter of national security. These are the truck flows that come out of various ports.
These three are the most amazing.
Okay.
Slides.
Yeah, so this is the port of New York, New Jersey. Houston, it's getting a little bigger. There's a lot going on there. Mm-hmm. And then Los Angeles, I mean, it's got some pretty good tentacles there. But this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, with Bellingham.
And that's just trucks. That's not even ships going up the Mississippi.
Yeah.
Yeah. Incredible.
So yeah. What is still moving on those red lines?
Everything. I mean, just...
See, I live in the corner way up there on top, and our lines go the other direction.
I mean, it's...
Because we have the Chinese and the other
coming
in.
International trade, it's this shirt, the dye that's in this shirt, the plastic that this computer is made with, the oil and gas in your car, the chemicals that paints are made out of, the steel that nails are made with, the steel that ships are built with.
So it's not just what's produced in Louisiana that's doing this. It's
the
ships from the world that are coming in that port.
Definitely.
Because it's a a port that took super tankers, you just said.
Yeah, not just super tankers though. If you're a farmer in Nebraska and you're shipping your grain out of here, then it's going to be trucked to a river, put in a silo, and then it's going to go in a barge that eventually is going to make it to New Orleans. And if you're growing soybeans, then they're probably going to end up at soy sauce in China or something. You know, I mean, this stuff is going to, it has to be moved out some way. And every day that the Mississippi River is down, and there's been occasions where ships have sank, etc., that's like $300 million the first day. And then every day after, it's exponential, the cost of having that waterway out of service. It's it would be an incredible loss to the country if that waterway had to be shut down for a month or something. For instance, if a hurricane came through there and shoaled up the shipping channel to where it needed, you know, a month's worth of maintenance. So it's you know, in taking care of the wetlands and keeping that shipping channel open are two things that kind of go hand in hand.
In that area, did they require double-hulled super tankers?
You know, so if it's an American flag vessel built after a certain year, mm-hmm. it does. Mm-hmm. But the only American flag vessels they're shipping from port to port. If anybody's familiar with the Jones Act, it's this, you know, kind of maritime security act that requires that we use like American seamen and, you know, American built, American staffed mm-hmm. vessels. But international ships, I think some of them are single hull. Remember when I was in grade school, a ship had lost steering, and in their infinite brilliance, they decided to throw the anchor instead of allowing it just to go up on the sandbar, and they ran over their own anchor, and they caused a massive oil spill. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was a double-hulled tanker or not, but I'll have to find that out.
We're requiring them in our area.
As it should be, you know, it's...
We had Alaska spill,
yeah,
and we all remember it well.
Yeah. You live near Valdez?
I know. I live in the state of Washington. I live on the Salish Sea, and we have a refiner. In fact, we have several.
So, two questions, and maybe you'll talk about them tomorrow, but can you tell us more about the BP settlement and what the money is going to go for? And the second question is sort of, who decides what it's going to go for?
Sure, so the BP settlement, they settled for, I believe it was $15 billion, and that covered a few different things. And, you know, I mean, this isn't my area of expertise, so I'm gonna try and do my best mm-hmm. here. but there were a few different ways this money is gonna go. But the short version is, Louisiana is poised to receive about $500 million each year for the next 15 years. That money is dedicated to coastal restoration. We had a small economic settlement the state did, which was $200 million. And the state is in such bad shape financially that they put it into the general fund. They didn't dedicate it to restoration. Mm. So, I mean, while I was unhappy with that, I mean, it was, you know, what can you do about that? You know, it's, mm-hmm. I think the state of Louisiana should have like $500 million in a bank account from the years that oil and gas were, you know, they were making money hand over fist from severance taxes, etc. And they blew that money on pet projects and giving everybody a company vehicle that worked for the state and all these other things, you know. But there's a good portion of that money is dedicated to barrier islands and diversions. So two of the things that we need the most, the money is dedicated for that, which is a really good thing.
So who draws up the plan then? For example, we're going to put a diversion here, we're going to put some sreds out in here. I noticed that you have several organizations as part of your group. Is it those organizations? Is it
State?
Do you know?
So the state has an agency that deals with coastal issues called the Coastal Restoration and Protection Authority. And, all right, anyway, they're tasked with, you know, making sure levees are built correctly and also that areas are restored to the best of their ability. And they're the ones that are pulling the levers, deciding where these things are going to be built.
Okay.
But that being said, CPRA, the only plans they have for a diversion are the structure itself and the conveyance channel. And so once you get out into the wetlands, they have zero planning. They have nothing planned. And what needs to be happening is, like what I was talking about with the terraces, we need to be building like a natural, like meandering river that has distributaries and key locations so sediment can fall out right where we want it to where we can actually enhance the estuary and make it more productive than it is now. And I firmly believe that that is possible, and I'm confident that there's science there that backs that up as well. The people that live there, that deal with this closest at hand, the users of the basin, are the ones that need to be planning that plan. And we are queued up to do that planning. And that's what my job is mostly about, planning for that. And I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that that happens with the most transparency, in the most democratic and equitable way possible. But yeah, as far as planning goes, they haven't decided on much out in basin. And so the operations working plan for the diversions actually calls for them not to be open fully the first few years because they have to let a channel develop. But I feel like if we get out ahead of it and dig these channels ourselves, you know, then we could open it wide open right away. We won't have to let that that channel develop on its own. It could be, you know, definitely much more strategic about where that land building would take place.
Does Louisiana have a robust coastal tourism?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's, I think, hundreds of millions of dollars spent annually on the coast. There's people from all around the country and world that go fishing there.
Uh-huh.
There's the waterfowl hunting is incredible. Uh-huh. The stories of black skies, that's definitely for real. Back in my days as a boat captain, I would pass through the Delta National Wildlife Refuge, and you know, the ducks and the geese would like really blacken the skies.
Mm-hmm.
They would show up on the radar of the boat.
Yeah.
There were so many. So if you're into deep sea fishing or fishing near shore, it's an absolute paradise. I don't know how I get any work done.
Sometimes that's the way you have to appeal to people to get any kind of political change, is the things you love to do are going to disappear if you don't do something.
Yeah, definitely. And it's to the point right now where charter captains...
Ducks Unlimited.
So the land loss and the collapse of the fishery is starting to get so bad. I've got friends of mine who are charter captains, so their job is just to ride around and catch fish. And they're talking amongst themselves about we need to lower the limits on certain species of fish because they're not there like they used to be. And it's because of the collapse of the marsh. You know, that the larval fish need these places, and if they're just going away, then those bigger fish can eat them. And they, you know,
like the whales and the krill.
Yeah, everything is connected, you know, for sure. But these guys that depend on catching a lot of fish and getting a nice tip, when they're talking about, like, man, we got to lower the limit, you know, because we can't keep doing this, things are really getting serious, you know. It's going to be an interesting next 50 years there.
Can you just tell us a little bit about your cypress tree planting?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I wish I had some photos that I could pull up on here. I planted about 15,000 cypress trees since 2010, and when I started, you know, I was working in the oil and gas industry, and I was driving this boat, you know, I was hauling guys in and out from the oil fields offshore to this port in the river delta, And I just, you know, got to the point where it's like, I've got to be doing absolutely anything within my power to change this dynamic around. You know, I didn't have much money, but I had time. I was working 7 days on, I was off for 7 days in a row. And so I put together this grassroots project where with the help of 20 volunteers, 4-H kids, you know, from the local school, we planted 1,400 trees in the morning. And we did this like 12 miles from the nearest road, and I was able to do all the logistics, get the lunches, round up transportation. I even made t-shirts to thank everybody and paid for it all myself. And I did it quick. It was like a 4-week time from idea till trees in the ground. After that, you know, I formed like an LLC to try and insulate myself and maybe start doing this full time. And so between my shifts as a boat captain, I started planting trees for the local port down there. And the next spring, I did a 5,000 tree planting. It was 28 working days. So I even took a week off the boat to do it all. But it's hard to convince people to invest in something that's going to take a generation to see the benefits of, unfortunately. Companies tend to think by the quarter, not by the decade.
By a stockholder meeting.
Exactly. But I mean, you know, there's PR reasons and things like that to do it. And, you know.
But that way you're going to stabilize the land. Is that the goal?
Absolutely, yes. And I want to show you some before and after pictures. I really hope I have them here for you. And I can pass this around. So this island right here was on its way out the door, and you can see how there's just a few little tufts of grass sticking up. And I came and I planted these trees here to try and hold on to the island. And this was in 2011. And this next picture was like 4 Sundays ago.
Oh, wow.
So it's really, really amazing.
Oh, wow. Right.
So this was 2011. And then probably sometime in June, I would say.
Is that the mango swamps?
It's cypress. And so what's happened is, you know, the trees themselves, the roots are holding the island together a bit.
Yeah.
But this floating vegetation is... This is the before picture. So you can see I had to put wire around the trees.
Sure, that's fine.
And this is the before. And
so you plant them into water.
Yes. It will.
Oh,
and intertidal areas.
Not that far down.
I didn't get that.
This is before photo.
But
it's sort of trees.
It's sort of in the bushy.
And then this is the same
but
photo
they
from
rot.
You can see there's other species starting to establish themselves. This is a bull tongue here. And then there's some cattails. Bull tongue?
That's what it's called.
And then there's cattails here that are establishing themselves.
Marty Lowe, the basket maker, would love to come.
Yeah,
for sure.
Cypress grows quickly?
It's kind of a medium growth tree, but it's impervious to rot, it's resistant to termites, and it can grow right out of the water. They're not going to establish themselves in water. The seedlings need land to establish themselves, but these are two-year-old trees, and so they're already able to make it. But to plant there, the ground is so soft, when you step off the boat, you will go to your waist. And so I had to take sheets of plywood that were about 2 feet wide and 6 feet long, and I drilled holes in the entire rope to them. And it was almost like scaffolding I was using to walk on the mud. And I took bamboo that's native to Louisiana, and I cut them in, you know, 20-foot joints or so, and I was able to drive them almost the entire joint of bamboo into the mud. It's so soft down there. And I used recycled crab trap wire to put around these trees. And what that did, there's an invasive rodent there, the nutria, and fur, you know, it's a popular fur. And after the fur trade in the 80s, when fur became unpopular, these nutria, the population just exploded. And so their teeth are growing up throughout their lifetime, and the only thing hard around here is the my cypress trees.
Oh.
So I planted like 700 in one spot, and they wiped them out in 2 weeks.
Oh,
so I started having to wrap them with this mesh. But all this being said, some things just can't be fixed with money. You have to get out there and like do the hard work. You can't fix certain areas with like massive equipment. You know, I'm sure y'all are experiencing that.
I picture it's a good place out there.
I know.
Up to their waist in mud. And
So is anybody doing a study on your area in terms of what's coming back in terms of birds and animals?
You know, some areas were hit worse than others, and it's... But yes, there's a lot of work going on, and there's this process called NERDA. It's this Natural Resource Damage Assessment.
Oh.
And that's a lot what the fines were determined by. Okay. And they were very specific. And believe it or not, ants. They looked at ants very carefully, because ants are like the canary in the coal mine. They're affected first, and these chemicals show up in their body. And if there's no ants around, something's definitely out of whack. And so they were able to determine a lot of damages through entomologists, instead of insects and stuff like that. But
you're kind of a one-man Johnny Appleseed.
Yeah, that's why I
don't
really want anyone to tell us about it. You've done wonderful work down there.
But I don't really do that anymore, because I feel like my time is better spent on the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
But that's enjoyable work, and it legitimizes what I do. I feel like...
You've been out there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But have other... like say the 4-H groups or Boy Scouts or Rotary or other charitable or non-profit, whatever you call it, service box, service agencies, are they doing it? Is it continuing?
4-H, yeah, sometimes. And one of the partner organizations in the Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana, they recently just celebrated their 10,000th tree they planted.
Oh, really?
Big party.
You've done 15,000 on your own.
Yeah.
Hey. Anyway.
Well, yeah.
I gave
party.
A lot.
Let it.
To,
let more people.
You know, I mean, a lot ended up in people's yards too. Not a lot, but like the year I planted the 5,000, I were 3,000 for myself. You know, so that that was a big year.
But every one of those kids who plants that tree is going to know more, and they're going to grow up to be a little more politically astute.
Mm-hmm.
They, yeah, absolutely, definitely. And that, those trees, like, I really like. It was worth it to distribute them in the community. I mean, just for myself, driving around and like seeing these trees that are now sometimes 15 or 30 feet high in people's yards, you know, it's kind of a reminder. The other day on Facebook, somebody sent me a picture of this tree, and they're like, "Hey, Richard, you remember that twig you gave me?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've got some that I planted just in 2010. I was able to hang a hammock up between, you know, so they're growing pretty good. But I mean, it's not all sunshine and rainbows, though. I mean, there's times like some of the trees, so those ones that y'all just saw that were out in the water are doing better than some on the land because of an invasive vine that covers them up, and the vine grows so much quicker than the tree. It just they kind of do like this, and it doesn't really exactly. So I mean,
there's nothing to keep the vines off of.
Is that
I try. I can't do everything.
Too fast growing.
That's it. I mean, I try ripping them off at the beginning of the season. There's big snakes out there and stuff. I don't know.
Well,
thanks, y'all, for taking the time to stay the whole time.
Oh, well, thank you.